Welcome back to the Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the Pitchfork Music Festival is just around the corner. The festival sets up in Union Park on Chicago's Near West Side, and it's become a staple for summer music lovers since 2005. This year is no different. The headliners like Broken Social Scene, Brian Wilson performing Pet Sounds, and Chicago R&B hitmaker Jeremiah. Well, all right, I'm going. The festival, of course, is the arm of the Pitchfork empire. The music site has grown to be one of the most dominant review sites around, not to mention the feature and multimedia content they produce as well. And the company is settling in after being purchased by Condé Nast last year. Not bad for a startup from Logan Square. So what's the secret to keeping a music media company thriving? Why don't we ask Pitchfork's first ever employee, now president, Chris Caskey. Chris, welcome to the Download. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So let's talk about this year's festival. I mean, you guys have obviously been in business for over a decade here. What is the theme? What are you trying to accomplish with the 2016 Pitchfork Fest?
We're trying to accomplish the same thing we tried to accomplish with our first festival back in 2005, which is being, you know, as your kind introduction kind of said, I mean, we're a music publication that exists online. And when we founded the festival, a lot of the impetus behind it was to create a tangible environment to celebrate the music that we were covering and love, the audience that was reading the site, the musicians that were reading the site, and then, you know, ultimately the community that had been kind of bubbling up and that we were finding relative but great success existing within. So not having a print side, not having things like that, we wanted to replicate that feeling and put it into a real-world setting. So every year has been an iteration and a growth and an optimization of what we do every year prior. So the goal is to celebrate music, right, and then have an event that with, you know, ancillary existence providing just fans with a comprehensive point where you walk in the room, and the room being a big park.
Right.
And your focus is on the music, and all of the rest of it is there to support that feeling. So,
you know, when you guys started, there was a lot of creative risks. You had a lot of artists coming in who were maybe, you know, doing their full record, their famous record, or maybe bringing some artists in that maybe twisted genres or were different than the norm. As you get older, do you run the risk, or what are the challenges that go with continuing to be creative when you now have thousands of people coming to the door looking for a mainstream festival?
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, the festival market's become a very interesting beast. There's a lot of festivals, and I would argue there's also probably a lot of homogenization amongst these festivals. So for us, the focus has always been somewhat indulgent, considering it's the second piece of our business, the media being the first piece, that we can have a little bit more fun in some ways with it. So if you look at what we do and the program that we put forward, I think the redundancy that you see across other festivals is extremely minimal, if any. I mean, I think if you were to compare us to Coachella, a much larger festival, obviously, you know, it's an equally large global brand. But I think we only have maybe five or six artists playing our festival that played Coachella. So if you know, we've carved out an identity for ourselves that is, again, it's focused on maybe what's emerging and what's coming up, and then it's celebrating things that we value and love from the past. And that kind of combination of new and old, and ultimately also kind of just flying under the umbrella of Pitchfork and not being about just having a big act,
right,
and being about the acts at noon being as important and potentially meaningful as those closing the day, that type of approach is something that I don't really think a lot of music festivals take. That's not the approach they take.
What's your process when picking a lineup? I mean, do you go out of your way to make sure that it's not the same stuff you're going to see at Lollapalooza or at other festivals that might be in the area?
Out of your way might be a little extreme, but we definitely are mindful of avoiding what seems to be like just like the glut of bands that play every festival. So for us, a lot of it is instinct, and a lot of the first bands we book are the ones that are the smallest and that we're most excited about that no one's even heard of yet. And it's obviously counter to what, you know, running successful business looks like. But when you think about on top of that, it's being unique is paramount. There's definitely a lot of work put forth to make sure that that thoughtfulness is going into the program. And we don't accept submissions. Everything is very much us going outwards. So with only 44 to 46 slots available,
right,
there's only so much we can do, you know. So it's more effort than
that. Do you, because of your roots in Chicago, because your office is in Logan Square, do you put an emphasis on trying to make sure that there's a local representation?
Absolutely. I mean, it's never going to be too heavy just because being in Chicago and this being our home and where we've grown, there's a need to show that respect and that love for the city. But being a global brand and a festival with global kind of perspective, it's only possible with the amount of slots that we have. But I think this year, which again, you go in and you want to have a few things happening, but this year, more than any other year, I think, we've got more Chicago representation happening, if I'm being totally honest, that we did not plan for, per se. that, and it's just a nice, it's a representation of what's happening in the Chicago music scene, which is exciting.
Well, we'll talk about that. But you know, I'm interested because your festival has grown and grown and grown to a point where, I mean, I remember going to one of the earlier festivals and then going last year to see Chance the Rapper and being mm-hmm. like, I don't know. First of all, I'm way too old for this.
Likewise.
Second of all, I couldn't believe how many people were there. I mean, it was just like, it was so intense. Pitchfork has had such a great run. How do, as a festival organizer, how do you make sure that you continue with what we just talked about, making sure you have a great lineup and grow with your audience in the sense that, you know, you have enough porta potties and, right. and, you know, like having a contingency plans and make sure and all the things that go along with putting on a festival?
No, completely. I mean, I think the one asterisk I'll add to your comment, which is true, but is that we, you know, we've actually stayed in the same park and had the same right. attendance, generally speaking. With the exception of a few thousand kind of people that we can add in.
I'm probably just getting old.
No,
there's so many people now.
But there's truth to it because what's happening now is that people are recognizing that thing I was saying earlier, which is you come in at noon and you stay all day.
Yeah,
so
right.
it's more crowded for longer periods of time now than someone just coming to see Wilco or just coming to see Chance. I mean, obviously, those are big moments. But the festival is largely a far more crowded atmosphere because I'd like to think we've done a good job of building things for people to do. If they get tired of the music or they need shade and they need a drink or food – so for us, I mean, if you were to ask me what's new this year and what's the most exciting thing, there's never been a good answer for that. It's always pretty mundane because what you do, and it's like what any business should do, what we try to do on our site, is every year there's optimizations made. There's porta potties. There's more ATMs. There's bigger screens, better sound equipment. You know, there's essentially logistical and production level mm-hmm. optimizations that we're making that are never designed to be pointed to and say, oh, this is a better festival suddenly. We want people to leave every year and think that it was better than the prior year and have no real reason that they know why, because the program should be equally good on a year-to-year basis. They should just walk away thinking it's better, and that's our job, is to kind of keep those changes subtle.
As a president of Pitchfork and all of you guys get together to organize a festival, do you, like, the week after, do you debrief and be like, okay, what didn't work? And be able to fix it for the next year?
I think we normally know about it the minute it's not working. So the debriefing is absolutely happening, but we take that first week and we take a vacation. But after that, yeah, I mean, every year you sit down and it starts with kind of like your blue sky. What do you want the most of? I mean, for a long time, we really wanted, video screens. And that took us a while just to get to our production to a level where we could afford it, frankly. And then you want better sound equipment and you want larger stages and then you want better lighting. So those things are always – there's a lot of wants on your list, and then that want lives next to the need column. And when those converge, you take action. But thankfully, there hasn't ever – I mean, with storm control and with rain and the potential variables of all the different things that can happen, we're always thinking about it. But the good news is there's so few of us at the core of it. That it you know, we treat it like a family, and we kind of have our fingers touching it so right. closely that when we're done with it, you just look at it and be like, we did that wrong. And we know exactly what's already happening when it's happening. So the good news, again, is that we can then take that, and it's not like some sweeping change. It just becomes we shift the stage 45 feet. The sound becomes 80% better because it's bouncing less off of X, Y, or Z, and we figured it out, and the audience is none the wiser.
Chris Caskey is my guest. He's the president of Pitchfork. Let's take a break. We come back.
Cool.
We'll shift from the festival, talk about the rest of the empire.
Let's do it.
The Pitchfork Music Festival happens here in July. Chris Caskey is my guest. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. My guest in studio at the big table, Chris Caskey. He's the president of Pitchfork. Unbelievable music media company, I guess is what you would call it, which is a publication,
mm-hmm.
with the website and also the festival, which happens here in Chicago and also in Paris,
mm-hmm.
which is, we'll talk about your international roots. But take us back to Chicago when this site started, when you started in 2004-ish.
Yeah, ish, yeah.
What were you trying to accomplish with Pitchfork?
Well, it was only two of us, and I think what we recognized was that it was leaving a moment where it wasn't nearly – looking back, it's easy to look at and point to. But at the time, we recognized that music was suddenly kind of ubiquitously available, and it was omnipresent. It was no longer the label structure that had as much meaning. Napster had kind of come and gone. MP3s existed. There's already obviously been a trading culture within like some of the jam band scenes, and music was everywhere. And at the same time, you know, the focal point of the site to that point had been, let's cover artists that are, you know, off the beaten path, that aren't just the biggest because they're on major labels and – they need to be on a cover magazine. Let's be a site that's different from that. And at the same, you know, when you shift that over to having not just being a voice for undiscovered artists or less talked about artists, it was also a scene where everyone else was kind of giving up on music in many ways, especially the criticism component mm-hmm. of it. It became a lifestyle. It became trying to be everything to everybody. And we never wanted to be everything to everybody. We wanted to be really good at what we did, at whatever we were doing, of course. And at the same time, knowing that we didn't have the money to start a print magazine, and we knew we had the audience that could support it as we were building it, we just wanted to – we set out to say, okay – it was very simple. I mean, it was like the festival was our physical counterpart in a way to offer something. If you look at like the umbrella of what we could be, that's a piece of – it's even adding the critical eye to what an event is. And it's a festival run by people that go to music festivals for a living, right? So with the site, it was let's redefine what the semantic of magazine means and what a publication is, and what does that mean for the internet? So whether that be how you design it, how you distribute it, how you think about writing it, the types of content you're creating – it was ambitious, but it just felt like, you know, we've usurped so many costs by not printing this on paper that let's go all in and figure out how to just blow this out.
And when I think of Pitchfork, I think of a couple of things that set the site apart from other sites. Even with Spin and Rolling Stone and other magazines that were online, they were still doing sort of their voice, but your voice was different. Your voice is clever. It's somewhat snarky, but it's also a great place for undiscovered stuff that's not everybody is circulating. But the other thing that was really big about it was the review concept, the decimal point, the idea of instead of stars and 1 through 5, you were doing a 0.0 through 10.
Right.
Talk about why you guys chose to do that as opposed to the normal, everybody knows, 5-star reviews.
5 stars are one thing. I mean, you know that it signifies perfect, but there's so much nuance to applying a score, and there's arrogance to it, and there's confidence, and we believe that you have to have like the foundation and the reputation and the like intellect and expertise to actually even be able to weigh in the first place. But when you look at Rolling Stone and everything's, you know, the mean is just 3.5 stars always.
Oh.
All of music is 3.5 stars. There's not a lot of like variance to that, and that's kind of frustrating. So when you think about also the amount of work that artists are putting into creating this stuff, whether it's in their bedroom or in a studio or beyond, I mean, why not go long on talking about it and get super analytical with how you approach what it is and how it's scored? So on a 100-point scale, essentially, 101, I guess, you can look at it and say – it's a very gray area, and you leave the reader up to interpreting what that score means, with the exception of how you label something like a best new album, for example.
Right.
But everything else is, oh, I know what a 6.3 means on Pitchfork versus a 6.6. Every audience member has it. Every person that reads our site has a different explanation for that, which I think is great. You know, there's no key that's instructing you as to what these things mean. So for some people, think a 6 is terrible. Some people think a 6 is mediocre. Some people don't know necessarily what to think a 6 is. But our goal is to never find that. We never want to just level out at all music being mediocre.
What I love about it, and you know, I kind of joked at the beginning, not bad for a startup from Logan Square, but I mean, you are changing the language. You know, the music language or music review language or how people interact even online has changed because of Pitchfork. The 6.0 and giving opportunities for people to express themselves or to have a better understanding of what goes into music. I mean, Pitchfork is at the forefront of that.
Yeah.
That, to me, is what I'm getting at, that you guys have not only dominated, but you've created new language.
No doubt about it. And I think you don't set out to create it, but I think what you do set out to create is to show how important music is to us specifically, and then to everyone that likes music, which is everyone. I mean, music's like pizza, and it's like a universal language. So to just dismiss it, and especially as music becomes more available and just you can click away from something immediately – that's not romantic anymore, and nostalgia is a part of music, and information is, and learning, and everyone's time is precious. So, you know, if you think about even how we're structuring the site now, we want to be as accessible and as useful to someone that's looking at it 30 times a day as you do to someone that's able to check you once a month and print out your best new music page. Like, there should be a home for everybody. Music should never feel like you can't get in. And when you think about how you talk about it and how you analyze it and what it means, it's to showcase and like replicate it's the importance of it in the cultural landscape, right? So, I mean, changing the language and changing democratized and leveled the playing field for kind of what matters. We weren't beholden to the music industry. We're in Chicago, looking outsiders, looking in on LA and New York, and having this, no one knew who we were, and we were avoiding press, and, you know, like, just kind of lived in the shadows and like, who are these people from Pitchfork?
At what point did you and Ryan and everyone else who was in that room recognize and realize that this was a phenomenon, that Pitchfork was growing, that you'd have to add people, but that this wasn't just sort of a music blog that people read?
There was two things that happened. First of which was we started kind of looking through your email accounts and all the unread email that you had and searched like query terms like Times or Tribune or, you know, and then suddenly you found reporters like, what is going on over here? Like, so many people had been diminishing digital as a different and terrible medium compared to print. when we always felt like the semantics of the business model, which is print and digital, all that mattered was what's in the middle of that, mm-hmm. which is the content that's going out there. So people were starting to take us seriously, and you saw the effect on like record labels and the music in the smaller music industry, where we would say something and then suddenly you're putting it in front of a lot more people than otherwise would have been able to be exposed to it. And it had a meaningful impact on their business. It was just anecdotal that you'd learn, because that wasn't our job. But I think, you know, the first festival we did was one thing, but I think in the Pitchfork Music Festival in 2006 was when, you know, you stood on stage and you look out to an audience of, you know, 18,000 people, and these people, they're singing along to the words of, you know, God, even who knows what the band would have been or what the example I could come up with would be. But thinking about that 4 years prior, when that artist was, you know, is a barista and they're just playing music at clubs and the music isn't available and being talked about, it's night and day. And in that feeling of seeing how important it was to the artists, like seeing them turn around and freak out with their bandmates and then turn around and watch the crowd love what they're doing, and have Les Savis Favre is a band that, you know, they were playing, they've been rock band forever, and suddenly they're in front of all of these people and the biggest show they ever play, and they're, you know, it's a surreal moment. And we all definitely look at each other like, all right, well, this is just kind of like a sample size of what's happening, what we do on a day-to-day basis on the internet, much larger than this. So I think it was a pretty heady moment for us, because we had to then sit back and say, all right, well, you know, reckless was never the intent, but we have to at least think about, right. You know, before every opinion we're never going to let be filtered, but just taking a minute to think about ourselves as you push publish, it goes out to millions of people suddenly. And
yeah, there's
didn't
a different,
do that before.
Yeah,
there's
right.
a different responsibility to that. And the responsibility we've ultimately decided is no different from what it was, which is to be honest and give our honest opinion and see where it goes. But it was pretty heady. It was a lot of moments that added up to some pretty surreal, you know, thankfully, since it all lives online, we wouldn't have to like live it in person all the time. There's no celebrity attached to it. It's I could still go home and not have to worry about it. But if you think about it, equating it to that, it's definitely pretty wild.
Let's take a break for the news. We'll come back, and I'd love to talk about now, because Condé Nast bought Pitchfork yep. in the fall, and you guys had kind of built yourself as sort of an independent, as you mentioned, about being able to be in Chicago and look out. But you have offices now in New York, mm-hmm. also one a remote office in L.A.
Yep, yep, yep.
But talk about growth and about the idea of being able to retain that independent vibe that made Pitchfork so successful in the late 2000s. Chris Cassie is my guest. He's the president of Pitchfork Music. We'll continue our conversation right after the news. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Chris Caskey. He's the president of Pitchfork. Of course, the festival, the site, everything that goes with Pitchfork. I mean, do you still consider Chicago or Pitchfork a Chicago company?
Absolutely. As much as we have offices now in a lot of places and we have music festivals in other places, I think that being a Chicago company from a literal headquarters standpoint, as well as thinking about the ideologies and kind of the approach with which we live our lives, it's a lot of it is founded in just what Chicago has taught us directly or indirectly, I think. So, yeah, I mean, this is our home.
Let's talk about the purchase, the Condé Nast purchase. Mm-hmm. They came in, the publishing company that does Vanity Fair and a lot of huge titles, came in and purchased Pitchfork back in October. How's it been? I mean, we're talking now coming up on eight months.
Yep.
Do you feel like everything is going smoothly with a boss?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the operative word is that we had never had a boss before, and it doesn't necessarily feel like we have one now, because, you know, without going into a 2-hour-long conversation about just like the ways in which this all worked and how it worked, at the end of the day, if we wanted to grow and if we wanted to have all of our wonderful people who work for us across all sorts of different areas, everyone's ambitions were, you know, hitting ceilings. You know, we could only do so much, and you see the ambition and you see that dissatisfaction that comes from not being able to accomplish what you want. And it's my job, of course, is to keep pushing that forward mm-hmm. in creating opportunity. And there's a lot of opportunity that exists, especially on the internet and in the digital world with startups and everything else. And for us, we didn't need just that. We needed people that were experts in that as well, and that could have real insight in historical precedence in operating something like a media brand like what Pitchfork is. So there was a moment in 2013 where we were nominated for an award. It's the Ask Me Awards, like the National Magazine Awards, and we were nominated for General Excellence for, you know, Website of the Year. So that basically the equivalent of, there's two of those awards. One goes to digital, one goes to print. And we were up against three or four Condé Nast brands, and those brands like The New Yorker and, like you said, Vanity Fair, and we have Vogue, and you have GQ, and these are brands that we respect, read, worship, admire, you know, just are humbled by, and we were up competing against them and nominated for this award. And then we won. And so that moment was not like, you're not about winning awards, your life isn't about awards, but it was a moment where we felt as though all of the work in some ways that we had done in the kind of more mundane inside baseball version of what we do, which is trying to be a magazine, trying to be a brand that is just like every other brand from a creative standpoint. It's just a matter of what our like way of distributing the content is that we were there. And the irony of that then became that we started having conversations with Condé Nast, and they agreed with that, which is you live alongside The New Yorker. You belong alongside GQ. I mean, you're as important of a brand to music as GQ is to style and fashion in menswear, and as Vogue is for fashion and style and, you know, social commentary. So we had a home there, and, you know, long and short of it was we can get to a point where we have these people who have built these brands over 100 years, and they're an independent company. So they're, you know, as much as we're now owned, we're still, you know,
part
the,
of an independent.
The cute part is that we're still part of, we have our own voice still.
What, I mean, you can't, you're not going to talk bad about your boss, but, you know, the challenges of being bought by a company that has all these brands. I mean, your consumer, and a little bit on the static pushback of, like, they're a very alt-savvy, independent-thinking audience.
Yep.
There's a lot of sellout kind of conversations around. So how do you avoid, as a brand, Pitchfork, one that really has really been a part of that movement, that independent movement, to not have consumers fall out of love with you because you're not independent
anymore? Yeah, no, I think, and it's a great question, and it's something we're absolutely mindful of, and you have to be, you know, vigilant and diligent about protecting yourself. So the pressures that you feel from something like Condé Nast are not negative ones. They're all challenges, and it's all experimentation, because the world of media is evolving in so many ways outside of us and outside of Condé Nast. And for us, like, it comes down to something that might be cliche, but it's about the work that we do. Like, if we go and we become a part of Condé Nast and our work starts to stink, then people will look at you and say, well, you did
full
it wrong.
Full glossy pages and stuff, like, in Pitchfork and stuff.
It's, I feel like it would be really clear to an audience like you described, which I agree with. It's, you have an audience that is loyal to you, that trusts what you say. You respect them. You respect that trust. And your job is to protect that and to give them things to read and like to look for and make sure that the 15 or so years of history you have that they can then reference online is as good as the 15 years after it. And I think that people are savvy enough with the amount of noise that exists right now that they see right through something that's not legitimate. And so for us, it's beyond our internal questioning and challenging to make sure we're making the right decisions and we're thinking about things in appropriate fashion. It's really just comes down to the instincts and saying, all right, well, what would we say does this make me feel like a sellout? Because if the answer is yes, your audience is going to feel the same way.
You know, on the same token, I was just, Pete and I were talking about this before the interview, just about you guys have become the dominant brand when it comes to music reviews. You know, it's not just anymore the little guy gets his mixtape reviewed.
Right.
Now it's everybody from Sony Music down wants a good rating in Pitchfork. How do you deal with the remnants of the music industry coming around and offering shiny things to make sure that Pitchfork gives them a good review? All the things that we've heard about in the history of media and the music industry, how does Pitchfork avoid playing favorites to the industry that still remains?
Yeah, you know, the beauty of it is, I think, by being in Chicago and by being in the shadows, that we never had any of that.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Not baloney. It's like we were never getting all these things that you see on TV or you hear about. That wasn't our world. Like, people could barely find our email addresses. So mailing address, getting CDs in the mail was as far as it got. And
that was a success.
Yeah, and we're like, yeah, if we get free music, and this is the best part of our job. You know, like, who doesn't want to listen to music all day? And, you know, with regards to how the music industry has evolved and its remnants is an apt way of putting it, but it's more just like, I think there's some re-identifying that's happening in a really healthy way, where people, even major labels, are realizing that you need to have an identity to exist. You need to have, like, a brand that means something to people. Otherwise, you're just, like, what good are you doing? Someone like Chance doesn't sign with a label because he can send his message out on his own. So if you're a label, like, where do you add the value now? And what's your game? And so for us, like, being on Pitchfork is our job to make sure we're listening to music and being exposed to it. But any temptation that exists or otherwise it's similar to, like, the selling out token. I mean, we're covering Justin Bieber records now, not because we're suddenly trying to amass an audience, but because Justin Bieber is working with Diplo, who works with MIA and who is, like, a part of our world now. And we'd be irresponsible not to cover it. So, you know, I think, yeah, the music industry is funny, but the best part and the simplest way to probably sum it up is that we've always been respectful of the music industry because of release dates and the product, like physical product specifically, when it was mattering more. There's a real business behind that, and you don't want to make something, you don't want to talk about something and have it not be available or do it any artist to disadvantage, because that's who ultimately you're hurting. But we never existed as a part of the music industry. Like, we live on the peripherals. We're a media company that happens to talk about music. So we're reliant on the creation of music and the fact that music keeps being created and put out in the world. But we don't care if Chance is putting a mixtape out or if Universal's putting a record out and putting bookends at Target. You know,
you don't have Jack Condé Nast or whoever, the guy playing golf, and he's like, my son's got a new record. You got to check
that. And every time that anyone does, not from Condé Nast, but the amount of times that someone's tried to give me a record, and almost every I don't think there's been a moment where I haven't said I won't listen to this. Not because I devalue your art, not because I don't want to, but like, let's just leave it. Let's leave our relationship as is. And then if you want to think about the music thing, like, let's figure out a different pathway for that, because this is not how it works. I mean, that's just not how we – I don't golf, you know?
All right, let's talk about Chicago. You know, do you see a Pitchfork, a future of Pitchfork not here? You know, at some point or another, you're blowing up in Paris. New York City is, I mean, obviously your second home, and now L.A. is coming up. At what point do you entertain the idea that Chicago, for all the things that we talked about, that you're not involved in, it's great to be outside, that it might be smarter for you guys to be closer to the industry?
You know, I think it's a hard question to answer. For me personally, and I don't believe that – you can never say never, so I'd be hesitant to be on record saying never. But I don't think that from a creative standpoint and from what we need to do that there's ever a need to leave Chicago. Just because if you go down just like to the brass tacks of what this city is, it's 30% cheaper to live here than it is in New York. So if you want to write for our site or you want to sell or you want to do whatever – coming here, it's a good move for you. Yeah. And there's a creative culture that exists here, whether it be musically or otherwise, that rivals any other major market in our country. So it would be doing the city a disservice to think that there's a need to get closer to any one industry, because ultimately the ad industry is fragmented, the music industry is fragmented, and it's kind of everywhere. And ultimately the benefit of the internet is that the internet is everywhere. So we live there. So, you know, being part of Chicago is – you know, as far as I guess if it's within my control, it's always a piece of our home. Now, the festival in Chicago is also as unique as it is, and it's what it is. And we don't replicate that model. Like, the Paris Festival is half the size. It's indoor. It's in the winter. And it's very much designed for a Parisian audience, a French audience, and a European audience most broadly. So it's not like we took a model that worked here and moved it. It's a completely different business and a completely different, like, creative outlet. So if we do something in L.A. or we do something in Vancouver or we go to Australia, it would be a new version of something that made sense for Vancouver or made sense for Melbourne or made sense for L.A. because it can't just be what we do here, because what we do here works because it's here. What we do elsewhere will have to work in ways that make sense for wherever that elsewhere might be.
You've seen some of the other festivals in town have, I guess you would call it, growing pains. You see Riot Fest having trouble with Humboldt Park and moving to Douglas Park. Lollapalooza seems to continue have problems with Grant Park, everything from fence jumpers to everything that happens.
We'll have 100,000 people in one spot, I guess, right?
But for you guys, I mean, do you foresee any troubles with Chicago and the idea of performing a festival in a public park?
I think so. I think troubles is the wrong word, but I think that because that signifies just like people issues. I think more of the issue is that almost similar to the way that people are like being exposed to music and listening to music, that there's so many festivals here and in every region, state, city, that unless you're a diligent listener and a follower of Pitchfork or you know what's going on, beyond us working hard to create our differentiation, you know, at some point, like, there's just enough's enough. There's too much of this. Like, there's too many festivals. And when a lot of these festivals they exist as businesses for 3 days and then they wait for an entire year to do it again, their focus is on business first, and rightly so, of course. But like, for us, the focus on successful festivals is number one, but it's a piece of a much larger business. So while we can talk about it all year round and we can think about it, it depressurizes the constraint or the overzealousness that you might put towards your event, because you know your life isn't made or broken over one weekend. So you know, when Riot Fest has issues, it's a business that needs to succeed, so they got to keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And so for us, you know, again, someone that's far more driven by financial gain, which is always something you're mindful of, you make decisions and you start to sacrifice that and you're problematic. But I think that the risk more in Chicago is going to be the glut of noise that exists and how to cut through that And it's on us. It's on every festival to figure out how you differentiate and make sure people are aware of what you do. So, you know, it's a different game now.
Well, this festival, the 2016 Pitchfork Fest, is going to be at Union Park. What's the one act that you're looking forward to? Like, what's something that you would like to recommend here to the WGN audience?
I think the thing that I'm probably personally most excited to see, and it's mostly because it spans, it's cross-generational, and it, you know, but it's Brian Wilson. So you have someone that's coming to perform Pet Sounds, which is my, I'll be standing next to my dad, you know, like that. He and my mom just inspired my passion for music and what I do, and they love Brian Wilson, and I grew up with Brian Wilson, and suddenly, you know, the full circle has arrived. So that will be neat, and I think that that story is replicated across everyone that likes music, especially that reads Pitchfork. And then as far as someone that's kind of on the other side of that, I think there's a kid, this kid called Car Seat Headrest, who is, he looks like he's 12 years old. He's probably 23. Makes me feel like a grandfather. But he's someone that is, you know, in a world where EDM's taking shape and there's a lot of kind of like just party music that's happening. He has a profound respect for indie rock in its purest form and the pioneers of indie rock. And even in a literal sense, he'll go and be quoting things or he'll throw like an homage in mid-song. But he's just got a very unique sound, a very unique approach to the way he makes music, at least it seems. And he's just is a level-headed kid that is making awesome stuff. And I think that he's someone that you look 2004 and you're like, you could see him bubbling up in world domination suddenly. And it's louder now, so that doesn't happen as easily in the music world. But he's someone that deserves it and is wearing his intent is very transparent, which I think still speaks to me, even though I'm aging. And it goes back to the sellout themes and everything else. You know, you see this and you're like, this kid's the real deal. You know,
there you go. That's a good endorsement for that kid.
Yeah.
The president of Pitchfork going, that kid's the real deal. We'll take it, right?
And then he comes and he's like wearing brand T-shirts and he's just like getting paid by McDonald's to.
Yeah, you
who knows, soccer jersey style.
The Pitchfork Fest is at Union Park this July. Chris Kasky is the president of Pitchfork, and he was my guest tonight here on The Download. Thanks so much for taking some time out.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.